Chapter 7. Special Weapons and Tactics. Hostage Rescue. In 1993, I passed the selection process and became a member of the Kalamazoo SWAT team, assigned to the Hostage Rescue Unit. I served on the team from 1993 to 2002. The training I received within the department and from formal tactical schools was by far the most effective police training I ever had during my career. How does an officer become a member of this elite team? Of course, many new officers and even childhood dreamers fantasize about being on a SWAT team. However, very few officers actually become members of such a force. In Kalamazoo, the selection process is based on several factors and continues to evolve as industry standards change and new ideas are inserted into the selection process. Back in 1993, when I was chosen, the selection process consisted of the following. Any officer who was off probation could submit a memo of interest. This is typically a 2-year or more employee. A file review, a physical skills endurance test, high-stress handgun qualification, scenario-based testing, and a final interview were part of the process. The file review examines how the prospective SWAT officer has functioned as a street-level PSO. SWAT commanders look for officers who are proactive and what we in the industry would call 10 percenters, that is, those officers who set themselves above the norm by being aggressive. By that, I mean nothing abusive, but an officer who seeks out crime before it happens, makes countless arrests, and conducts rock-solid investigations. In addition, such an officer is proactive in police-citizen contacts, proactive in traffic law enforcement, drug interdiction, and warrant arrests, and is professional in demeanor when dealing with subjects who are cooperative, potentially uncooperative, and totally uncooperative. This kind of officer is early to work, possesses a great work ethic, seeks self-improvement, seeks department improvement, gives feedback to supervisors on how to make the department a better organization, and holds himself or herself accountable to always do the right thing and to be a leader. Military experience is also considered, but more important is the officer's ability to work as an effective member of a team and be a clear thinker under the most stressful and violent situations. My 9 years with the Kalamazoo SWAT team proved to be a time in my career that I call tactical transitioning. This is a term I created to describe what happens when an officer transitions from a street cop to a highly trained tactical operator. Officers in this phase have some solid street experience under their belts, but then transition into the next phase of their careers in which they become true subject matter experts in the art of honing their tactical mindset. The training with a SWAT team was intense, evolving, demanding, and dangerous, and it blended with my street duties as a public safety officer. It also coincided with the department's efforts to increase tactical patrol training for street officers, in addition to creating a new field training program within the agency. The 1990s were a great time for Kalamazoo Public Safety, and I really think this is where the agency became a progressive department, with the internal professionalization of many areas of the department. My exposure and expertise, however, were entirely related to patrol. At KDPS, we referred to patrol as the operations division, the backbone of the department. How does a SWAT team train? In Kalamazoo, we were granted 1 day per month to dedicated team training. Each training day was a 12-hour day that overlapped both day and night. Each month was a different topic taught by different subject matter experts on the team. In addition to in-service training, team members were sent to outside schools across the country to train with other SWAT teams, as well as attend nationally recognized seminars, such as those offered by the National Tactical Officers Association and West Michigan Tactical Officers Association. This outside training was an excellent concept because it allowed selected officers to attend school and then come back to the department and train our members on any new tactics that were learned. This practice also proved to be highly cost-effective and is a must for any agency to get the best bang for their buck in regard to training costs. The key, however, is to hold these officers accountable and set aside in-house training sessions to ensure that the training gained is passed on through the ranks of the department. This in-house training proved crucial in the area of hostage rescue for our team and resulted in a higher level of expertise and performance in the area of building entries, room clearing, and hostage rescue tactics. My 9 years on the SWAT team wasn't without incident. Some of my most dangerous and humorous moments took place during SWAT-related activities. As I look back, I know that this intensity was because we all knew that any call-out could be our last, and we could fall victim to a suspect's bullet, like so many of our comrades have from across the country. Command to Entry 1. Entry 1. Entry 1, move to the entry position. You have control. Entry 1, clear on control. Entry 1, moving to the entry position. Command, we are in the entry position. Entry 1, clear, you are in the entry position. Command, Entry 1, you have command and control authority. Entry 1, clear on command and control. Entry 1, stand by, stand by. Initiate, initiate, initiate. React 1 to Entry 1, S1 is in the kitchen. Shots fired, suspect down. The Knights Inn Motel was the scene of two SWAT team moments that had a career-altering effect on me. Each incident, though separate, had similar traits that resulted in both tragedy and victory for our team. One of the great aspects of our chosen profession is that we are quick to learn from past mistakes and are constantly training for and anticipating future events so that they can be handled better than the call before. We are always seeking self-improvement in our actions. The first of such incidents ended in tragedy for the suspect involved. Two detectives from the Allegan County Sheriff's Department had descended upon the Knights Inn to arrest a subject inside. When the detectives knocked on the door and spoke to the suspect, he indicated that he wasn't coming out and that he would kill the first pig who came through the door. The suspect then fired a gun inside the motel room to express his determination not to go to jail. This shot prompted the detectives to request additional assistance from Kalamazoo Public Safety, which in turn resulted in a SWAT team call-up to handle a barricaded subject incident. The incident started out in the late afternoon hours and continued on into the early morning hours of the next day. One of the benefits a SWAT team has when dealing with a barricaded subject is time. Time is on our side. Time allows for a tactical team to establish negotiations, conduct reconnaissance, and determine suspect location, mindset, emotional state, level of aggressiveness, and willingness or unwillingness to surrender. Time also allows for entry teams to rehearse actions upon contact and contingencies prior to making entry. In the case of a motel room, a team is often able to rehearse in an identical motel room that has the same layout and design as the target location. It is nearly a perfect scenario for a tactical team. The great thing about rehearsals is that it takes the guesswork out of the mind of the officers making entry. Rehearse, rehearse, and rehearse. Sometimes, however, there is no rehearsal time, and an emergency entry must be made in active shooter situations where direct intervention is necessary to save lives and end the violence. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case in this incident. All of the pieces listed above had been put into place perfectly, yet there is one thing that is always out of your control as a police officer: suspect actions. Officers always try to anticipate suspect actions, but like the weather, we can't control the offensive actions of another human being, but can only react to them. Being mindful of the danger cues associated with these actions through our training and experience helps us to acknowledge these danger signs. I was the first tactical officer through the door after it was breached. As I made entry into the dark motel room, there was only one thought on my mind: get to the kitchen. The flashlight on the end of my MP5 pierced through the tear gas and flashbang smoke in a narrow beam. Everything seemed to happen at the same time. The suspect looked like a silhouette in my flashlight beam as he dropped to the floor. I don't remember hearing any gunshots. I simply saw his body fall limp to the ground. The suspect had shot himself in the head as the team was making entry. During rehearsals, I had mentally prepared myself for a deadly force encounter, and like any good officer, was looking forward to a good fight. The thought of being shot or killed never crossed my mind and was never an option. I simply convinced myself that the suspect would either surrender or would be firing on me during entry, and that I would have perfect shot placement to end the threat. I had not mentally prepared for option three. The suspect would kill himself before my eyes. When this happened, I felt cheated. This is not what was supposed to happen, I thought. We spent all this time preparing to take him into custody or administer deadly force if needed. Suspect suicide was never an option. The entire team felt like we had failed. Most noticeably affected by this tragic turn of events were our hostage negotiators. They had spent hours and hours talking to the suspect, working every angle to convince him to surrender. Suddenly, the person they had spent the hours talking to was dead. They felt terrible, and I was certainly a close second. I think that all of the negative emotions on our faces, although nonverbal, were continuing to build and build inside my mind. I found myself second-guessing my own actions and that of our team. Did we do everything possible to prevent this death? Was there something we could have done differently that would have resulted in a living apprehension? I found that I was actually blaming myself for his death. The day following the incident, we conducted our critical incident stress debriefing. As the debriefing began, I felt myself getting hot and feeling flushed, just sitting in a circle of chairs with other officers. All the officers explained their roles in the incident and how they felt. The department psychologist was present and asked some really pointed questions. When the debriefing began, it seemed like nobody was affected by the situation. Was I the only one? I thought. Or were the guys just being too manly about the situation? I felt my heart racing and my palms sweating as my turn was fast approaching. I leaned forward in my chair with my hands on my knees and said, "I feel like shit." I told the group that I was blaming myself for the suspect's death. I couldn't put into words why I felt this way, but I remember telling them that I trained and prepared for every option except for the suspect killing himself. I felt that if I had also considered this as an option, I would not be experiencing the post-traumatic stress that I was now shouldering. When the inspector and the psychologist inquired, I said I didn't think the incident would hinder my ability to continue working my shift. I just felt like I needed to express my emotions because they were tearing me up inside. My voice cracked, and I forced myself to hold back the tears, but I really just felt like shit inside. This incident continued to bother me for a good 6 months before I was convinced that it wasn't my personal actions that caused the suspect to kill himself, and that he made that decision when he put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger. My partners were the best healers I could have had. Many of them would ask if I was doing okay and would give me a pat of reassurance on the back. They told me I did a great job on the scene. This was the best therapy I could have had. The assurance from my teammates that I did the right thing and nothing was my fault. The camaraderie of our team was unbreakable, and it was this bond in battle that kept us strong and developed us into a great force for good. The end goal in any situation is for the suspect to be apprehended with no injuries to officers, civilians, or the suspect. Entry 1, command, we are in the entry position. Entry 1, you have command and control. Clear on that command. Entry 1 has control. Entry 1, breacher up. Stand by, stand by, stand by. Initiate, initiate, initiate. An incident with a second barricaded subject at the Knight's Inn took place later during this same year. Ironically, it was on the same floor and only 3 rooms away from the first tragedy. This incident, however, ended with a more preferred outcome. The suspect was arrested without injury. The incident started out as public safety officers were dispatched to the Knight's Inn Motel after a report of a subject screaming and yelling. As the officer knocked on the door, the subject opened up the door slowly and then reached through the door opening with a knife and tried to stab the officer. The officer slammed the door shut and requested backup. The incident resulted in a barricaded subject armed with a knife and wanted for felonious assault against a police officer. The incident had similar traits to our previous barricaded gunman call. The SWAT team again conducted extensive rehearsals, using an identical motel room for practice. Meanwhile, a REACT team was in position, and negotiators were attempting to make contact with the suspect. This time, though, negotiators made no contact, so the intelligence that would normally be gained through verbal negotiations with the suspect wasn't known. The waiting time came to a quick end. Only a few hours had gone by when the decision to send in the entry team was made. There was an interesting twist, though, to the command decision on whether or not to make entry or to continue ongoing efforts to establish subject contact. I had the occasion to be present in the command center during the decision-making process by the Chief of Public Safety and his other top commanders. The process was not like anything I had seen before. Essentially, the decision to allow the SWAT team to make entry was the chief's responsibility. I watched as the chief asked each of his commanders about his or her personal thoughts on what should be done. All but one commander insisted that entry be made. One, however, said, "I'll pass." The chief said, "You can't pass. Tell me what you think." The underlying issue was that each commander in the room knew that if the SWAT team made entry and was confronted by a knife-wielding suspect, that deadly force would surely be administered. The entry team had other options in mind. In our minds, we knew we were dealing with an emotionally deranged person, or EDP, as cops refer to them. We knew that there was a chance that the suspect could be incapacitated with high-pressure aerosol spray, and deadly force may not be needed. The chief made the decision. Make entry and get this thing over with. The breacher smashed down the door. Multiple flashbangs were deployed, and I made entry through the doorway. My focus was directed to the suspect's hands. No knife, I thought. The suspect ran toward the bathroom door, but he was doused in pepper spray and instantly pushed to the ground and handcuffed. The suspect wasn't armed. Mission success. Mission success. This was one of those high-five moments that the public does not see. After the room was checked for any additional suspects, our team left the room and redeployed to our staging area. The balaclavas and helmets were peeled off our heads and faces, weapons were placed on safety, and entry vests were peeled off our sweat-soaked bodies, and the high-fives and celebratory hand slaps took place. We were on cloud nine. Did we want to take a life that day? Hell no. Were we prepared to do so? Hell yes. As officers, our fundamental duty is to serve and protect. The successful apprehension of any violent offender is our ultimate goal. Radio Zone 3, start for Horace Avenue. A male subject called 911 reporting he had just cut his wife's throat. At 6:30 in the morning, the shift responded to this 911 call. Normally at that time, officers are conducting shift change procedures, finishing their workouts, peeling themselves out of the station lazy boy chairs, and drinking fresh coffee while catching up on the gossip of the day. This call was not how we wanted to end or begin our shift, and I was exhausted from having worked the entire night. This was the last thing I wanted to deal with, but duty called. When officers made contact at the home, they found a female lying on the front porch. She had bled severely from the neck and died. The male suspect who called 911 remained inside the home and was refusing to come out. The call resulted in another SWAT call-up for a barricaded subject. This call, however, was fast-paced and over within just a few hours. I arrived on scene and reported to the command post. I was quickly assigned to the REACT team and sent to a staging area adjacent to the front porch of the home. The suspect inside was threatening to burn down the house and kill himself. Shortly after meeting up with my partners, I noticed that other PSOs had been put into fire suppression positions next to us by the house. Meanwhile, a second REACT team took up a position at the rear of the home that also had an attached garage. While both our teams were taking up our positions, light smoke began to emit from underneath the eaves of the house, and flames could be seen inside through the front window. The suspect carried out his threats and set his own house on fire while inside. This development created a flurry of activity on the scene and chatter over our SWAT radio system. Command had directed both REACT teams to make an emergency entry with the fire suppression team. This was a challenge our team had never faced. The issue at hand was to protect the fire suppression team while making an emergency entry to apprehend the suspect. I took up a new position at the rear of the home with the entry team, while the fire suppression team was told to hold its position. Our intent was to make entry at the back of the home and apprehend the suspect before the fire spread out of control. Contrary to any type of fire suppression operation, our SWAT team was to make entry into a smoke-filled structure with a rapidly spreading fire in an effort to essentially conduct a search and rescue of an armed and dangerous murder suspect. At the garage area near the back of the home, the entry team began its assault. Multiple pepper spray canisters and flashbangs were simultaneously deployed into each window while the entry team breached the back door. The front react team and fire suppression team were ordered to hold their positions until a search for the suspect could be conducted. I remember entering the garage area, which was filled with pepper spray gas and flashbang smoke, and the air was filling rapidly with choking house fire smoke. There was a significant temperature change inside the home because the fire in the front of the house was spreading rapidly. "Suspect down! Suspect down!" I yelled out as our team located the suspect in a corner of the smoke-filled garage. He was completely naked and covered in an oily substance and looked bloated and puffy for some reason. He was taken into custody as our team leader directed the react team to enter the front of the building and provide security to the initial fire attack team. There was no rehearsal for this incident. We simply reacted to the circumstances at hand. Later in the afternoon, I learned that the suspect died at the hospital that same day. I was shocked, and his death made no sense to me. My first thoughts were that he died from the smoke or pepper spray inhalation, but it was determined that he actually died from a drug overdose. In Kalamazoo, we are fortunate to all be cross-trained as both police officers and firefighters. We knew that the officers on the nozzle were also cops who were not afraid to face a suspect's bullet. In turn, they trusted their lives to their armed SWAT partners who would protect them during the initial fire attack had they confronted the suspect in an armed confrontation. Unfortunately, for many agencies, this is not the case. When was the last time your police department conducted joint training with the firefighters of your area? Calls like the one just described are certainly not unique, although rare during dangerous situations, particularly involving barricaded subjects. There is a fire danger present. Tactical aspects include 1. Negotiations. 2. Surveillance. 3. Establishment of a react team. 4. Evacuations of bystanders in proximity to the target location to ensure the safety of the nearby public. 5. Traffic control. 6. Establishment of media safe zones. 7. Entry team rehearsals, staging locations, entry positions, chemical agent deployment, breaching procedures, actions upon entry, actions upon suspect contact, room clearing tactics, officer down drills, deadly force encounter, multiple suspects or hostages, barricaded entry points and alternate entry points, rouse distraction techniques. 8. Actions upon surrender. 9. Actions for emergency entry, react team responsibility. 10. SWAT sniper positioning, spotters. 11. Search warrant, arrest warrant procurement. 12. Tactical EMS fire support. 13. Hospital ER notification. 14. Evacuation procedures. And 15. Food rest plans for officers. I decided to write about only the most memorable SWAT calls I had. Our team was an on-call SWAT team made up of highly trained tactical officers who spent the remainder of their duty days at their assigned positions throughout the department. When a call would take place, each officer was pager notified and would respond according to the emergency at hand. As I look back at my 9 years on the team, I am proud to see the accomplishments that I had as an individual member of the organization. It was an honor to serve with these professional officers, and I take great pleasure and being able to look back at my SWAT team days and know that I helped make the team a better unit than when I was selected to become a member. During my tenure on the team, I worked to create the SWAT Medic program with the local medical control and Life EMS ambulance service and helped develop and instruct the first mobile active shooter training program in Kalamazoo County. I certainly appreciate the opportunity I was given by Kalamazoo Public Safety to be a member of this amazing team. Among all of these memorable SWAT calls, what else happens? Training, training, and more training. With any battle-hardened team comes the brotherhood and camaraderie associated with the team concept. Some of my most comedic and memorable events were not dealing with the public, but dealing with my fellow officers. You just can't make this stuff up. Imagine a fully loaded, breadbox-style van of SWAT officers set to pull out of the back of the training division with a new SWAT officer at the wheel. We were ready to execute a search warrant and had our heart rates up, equipment checked, radios programmed, weapons loaded, and minds all focused on the mission at hand. The van's engine started up and the vehicle made a violent leap forward, crashing head-on into the AT&T telephone building adjacent to the parking lot. Officers were piled up on the floor, into the doorway, and against the front glass. Amid the cursing, laughing, and utter chaos of officers lying on top of each other, bullets scattered about the floor, gear and helmets flying through the air, one voice rang out, "Hey, don't start the van with it in gear." On another occasion, the SWAT team was traveling to a high-risk drug raid to execute a search warrant. Intelligence suggested that the suspects were armed and dangerous and were smuggling drugs from Detroit to Kalamazoo. Kalamazoo SWAT was on the way. The van was quiet as we were all listening to the I update command on movement at the house. Another new SWAT officer was at the wheel of the van. As we approached an intersection, the van suddenly came to an abrupt stop. 8 SWAT officers who were all standing up in the van, holding onto the bars above, sweat running down their brows from the lack of air conditioning, went flying forward into a pile near the driver at the front of the van. The smooth voice of Officer Calvin Oliver spoke up out of the pile. "Next time, just run the light." Then the laughter began, as we slowly peeled ourselves off one another from our heap of ballistic vests, helmets, and MP5 submachine guns. We retook our positions and prepared to continue on with our mission. I think I actually made entry into the house, still laughing from the event. As the point man on the entry team, I was lucky enough to be at the back of the van and be on top of this pig pile of cops. Police training can be just as deadly as dealing with suspects. How do officers get shot during training or by accident? As cops, we are handling guns on a daily basis, be it our own or that of a suspect. The problem with cops is that we think we know what we're doing with firearms because we're used to handling them so much. The act of handling a weapon actually becomes routine. Routine is one of the worst words in the law enforcement profession. There is nothing routine about handling weapons, just as there should not be anything routine about dealing with the public at any level. Many such gun incidents come to mind as I look back in my career. Every incident dealt with carelessness on the part of the officer involved. My first near-miss incident took place during SWAT training when we were practicing vehicle assaults. The scenario was a suspect about to go mobile in a vehicle with a hostage. The hostage rescue team made its approach to the suspect vehicle simultaneously with SWAT snipers who initiated fire along with the deployment of distraction devices on the hood of the vehicle. During our training, my team made its approach, and the suspect was identified as the figure sitting in the driver's seat. As I made my approach along the driver's side of the car, my adrenaline got the best of me, and I pushed my handgun forward to the mannequin suspect's head for a close headshot, while other officers were firing through the back window at the driver's head. Screaming in the background was the SWAT commander, "Cease fire! Cease fire!" Of course, nobody could hear him when the triggers were being pulled. The assault completed, the commander brought to my attention that both of my hands were inside the suspect vehicle while firing. Fortunately for me, The headrest of the driver's seat soaked up the 9mm rounds being fired through the back windows, and my hands were not shot off. Note to self, when making a headshot to a suspect and other officers are shooting into the car, don't put your hands inside the car. Assume every weapon is loaded and never become complacent. Horseplay. Absolutely not permitted. But within our SWAT ranks, it happened. I was in the back of the van returning to the station after day-long hostage rescue training when bad turned worse. Horseplay is the only way to describe what happened. One officer had loaded his handgun and placed it back into his thigh holster, while another officer unholstered this same weapon to demonstrate some sort of ridiculous act of courage and pulled the trigger. Thank God the only damage was to the floor of the van. The look on the face of the officer who pulled the trigger went from laughter to shock when the gunshot rang out inside the van. We could not believe what had just happened, and we felt our bodies to see if we'd been shot. This completely ruined the training day and resulted in severe disciplinary action. High-risk drug search warrants always stressed me out the most. I think the buildup of anticipation and fear of the unknown were contributing factors to this anxiety. The sequence of events was as follows. It all started when the pager went off. Then there was the drive into the station, getting dressed, grabbing the gear pack, and checking weapons. This was followed by the intelligence briefings, where you were locked in the briefing room with no phone use. Then came the dry run rehearsals on actions upon entry and actions upon contact, with officer down drills and deadly force drills. Added to the preparations were map overlays and a review of photos, subject pedigree, and past history of violence, and suspected weapons and barricades. Officers would do deep breathing to try to stay cool under the heavy body armor. There was a constant buildup of anxiety to the van ride. We were all thinking of contingencies and what-ifs. What if I get hit? What will I do? What if my partner gets shot? What will I do? It all comes to a moment of climax, when the first flashbangs are deployed. Then rooms are cleared and suspects are taken into custody, followed by primary-secondary searches, weapon safety checks, and then a reload back to the van. The adrenaline dump happens during the ride back to the station. I've even seen guys fall asleep heading back to the station. That's all as a result of the adrenaline dump, the drop in heart rate and blood pressure, and a sigh of relief. As a tactical officer, you must remove all aspects associated with fear. Use this feeling of anticipation as a strength to continue on with the mission. If not, it will consume you. You must not think about anything but victory and mission completion, no matter what. Even if shots are fired, the mission continues. Something I wish I could have been told as a SWAT officer was something that one of my best friends, Keaton Nielsen, told me as we made final approach into Kabul, Afghanistan, on a C-17 transport plane on deployment in 2009. The feeling was tense as we were preparing to land in a combat zone. Keaton, who was sitting next to me in the plane, leaned over and yelled out, "Just consider yourself dead and you'll do just fine." This made complete and total sense to me. All aspects of reality and life were out of my hands, and simply in the control of my surroundings. I had to survive and thrive in this hell if I was to ever make it out of here alive. You can't think about the possibility of getting killed. You must think of just winning, surviving, and doing the job at hand. I'll talk more about Officer Keaton Nielsen later, as he proved to be one of the most influential people in my life, and still is to this day.